All right, Hebrews 10, let's begin. For the law, having a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with these same sacrifice, which they offer continually year by year, make those who approach God perfect. And again, just, we don't have time, but you should go back and read the latter part of chapter 9, as this is just one singular letter. And we're kind of interrupting the logic a little bit. But let's keep moving on. Verse 2, for then would they not have ceased to be offered? For the worshipers, once purified, would have no more conscience of sin. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins every year. For it is not possible that the blood of bull and goats could take away sin. Therefore, because of that, when he came into the world, he said, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the volume of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God. Previously saying, sacrifice and offerings, burnt offerings and offerings for sin you did not desire, nor had pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law. Then he said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God. He takes away the first covenant that he may establish the second covenant. By that will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And we could take time to park there and develop that, because just in the previous verses, he was saying, it doesn't occur perfectly. It doesn't make them perfect. So they have to do it again and again and again. And now we're reminded just one more time there. In verse 10, it was once for all. And then he develops it a little bit here in verse 11. And every priest stands ministering daily and offering repeatedly the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. But this man, after he sat down at the right hand of God, from that time waiting till his enemies are made his footstools, for by one offering he has perfected forever those who are being sanctified. But the Holy Spirit also witnesses for us, for after he had said before, this is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law into their hearts, and into their minds I will write them. Then he adds, their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more. That is a good verse to share with those who are wondering, can we lose our salvation? There is an element of covenantal promise that God has involved in this salvation. Verse 18, now where there is remission of these, there is no longer an offering for sin. Verse 19, wherefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiness by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil that is his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a heart true in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled with an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water, and let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another so much more as you see the day approaching. For if we sin willfully after we receive the knowledge of the truth, there is no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversaries. Anyone who has rejected Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace? For we know him who says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But Recall the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great struggle with sufferings, partly while you were made a spectacle both by reproaches and tribulations, and partly while you were become companions of those who were so treated. For you had compassion on me in my chains and joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods, knowing that you had a better and enduring possessions for yourself in heaven. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance, because they're going through some difficult times, so that you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise, yet for a little while, and he who is coming will come and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but those who believe to the saving of the soul. And let's look at just a couple of these verses. Today, we're going to be looking at Hebrews again. But I want to open it up with an introduction this way. Back in Noah's day, how many people survived the flood? Eight. All of the other population of the world was destroyed, right? But just those eight. So my question for you today is, how then did the Hawaiian Islands get populated? But right in the middle of that Pacific Ocean is Hawaii. My question is, how in the world did Hawaii get populated if all the population was destroyed back in Genesis 6? Now again, it might not have been a very good slide, but as you can kind of see there in the bottom corner, there's a lot of islands and strings of islands that go from Thailand to Australia, and there's the Fiji Islands, and they're all kind of close. But when you get to Hawaii, that's right in the middle of nowhere, and it's kind of hard to do some island hopping. How is it populated? Well, no one knows exactly for sure when the Hawaiian Islands were populated, but anthropologists agree that it was a bunch of seafaring Polynesians who inhabited and explored many of those islands down around Australia. What they did was each year they noticed a bird called the golden plover, which migrated north every year. It came into their islands, and then it would just head off into the sea. And the Polynesians said, you know what? There's got to be land out there somewhere. So they would get in their very primitive dugout canoes with possibly some sorts of sails or outriggers, and they would paddle for as far and long as they could and had supplies with their very, again, basic navigation of the stars and the sun and such. And then when they ran out or they lost the birds because the birds were going faster than them, they'd go back. And each year, they would just try to go further and further and further out until they reached the Hawaiian Islands some 400 years later, says the anthropologists. So if the anthropologists are correct, the Polynesian sailors sailed north following only birds as far as they could for 400 years. That is really amazing. The tenacity of these people is really amazing. But it should be the same way with us. Because of the assurance of our faith, because of the promises of God, we should be very tenacious in our faith as well. Very rarely, if ever, should a trial come in our life or we put our faith on hold, we shake our fist at God and say, why me? Why this? Why now? We shouldn't be so quick to abandon the promises and the assurances of God and just go off in despair, shaking our fist at God. We need to be tenacious. There are many situations in life that do call for a dogged determination. We've got many on our prayer sheet that have just continual chronic, let's just call them maladies. But they continue to operate day by day, even with the maladies. For example, if you had just a blinding migraine and you had them regularly and you were working, you probably didn't have enough sick days to call in sick every day. You go to work with the blinding headache. For some, it's financial setback. something has happened to them and they're going to have to live a very frugal life for a long period of time in order to get back into a positive cash flow. But they do it. And they do it for a long time, living very frugally. For some, it's like a physical disability. We were in a conference this past weekend, or just the other day, Friday, Saturday, and like brain injury, traumatic brain injury. You know, life still goes on, and you still have to care for the individual or the person who's disabled. There may not be the full functioning, but life still has to go on. Maybe it's a difficult home situation. Home is not a haven of rest, but a hot spot of hostility, but you still go home. There's many things that we have in life that we don't necessarily care or we don't really like it, but life still continues and we can still use to function even in the midst of some great hardships. And that needs to be the same with us as Christians. We need to be very much tenacious about our faith. There is now the author's caution, and I want to show you some of the cautions that the author had. As we read there in chapter 10, he says, now listen, some of you have been publicly ridiculed. Some of you have suffered reproach. You know that I'm in chains. Some of you have had all your possessions taken from you. They're going through a lot of hardships, and the author of Hebrews is kind of encouraging them, or he's got some concern saying, listen, I don't want you to jump ship. I want you to hang tough. I want you to stay the course. So you see it up in the screen, chapter 2, verse 1. That's the first warning. He says, don't drift. And again, it's not like he's saying, don't cut the ropes, set sail, and go the opposite way. It's basically the mooring rope is just loosened up. There wasn't a lot of diligence, and you're just kind of passively drifting further and further from that relationship with God. He goes on there in chapter 2, verse 3. He says, don't neglect this salvation. Chapter 3, verse 1, don't stop considering, focusing, making a compulsive thought to be Jesus. Don't stop doing that. Then he says there in chapter 3, verse 12, don't let there be an evil or unbelieving heart. And again, I believe Hebrews was written to the Hebrews who were professing Christians. Now, obviously, there was probably a mixed multitude to which some of these warnings were taking place. But in chapter 10, I don't think anybody but Christians would allow themselves to be publicly rebuked or have reproach or have their goods seized. They were being persecuted from their faith, and yet he says, listen, in your situation, in the difficult situation, whether it's financial, whether it's home, whether it's physical, whether whatever the relationship is, don't allow that to develop within you an unbelieving heart. And then in chapter 4, he says, don't be a slug. Don't be dull of hearing. Don't be just hearing it and not letting it impact you. You know, it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. Don't be dull hearing. Don't be immature. And then he goes on there in chapter 10. We saw that a little bit here. Don't throw away your confidence. Hold your confidence fast. And then we'll see a little bit further. Don't grow weary in the doing of well. You and I, we need to hold fast to our confession of faith. We need to hold fast, especially because they were in a precarious position, and you might be in a difficult situation. Our country may become in a much very difficult situation, depending upon who's elected, cabinet and members that are appointed, Supreme Court justices that are put on the bench. Our country could really take a dire turn in my mind. And we all could be in great difficulty. But we need to hold fast our confession of our hope. Look at chapter 10, verse 23. Again, there is a real danger of not holding it. And we just read quickly some of those verses throughout the book. And there was a real danger because, again, of the price that was costing them. You see that again down there in verse 34. He says, you've had compassion on me in my chains. You've been made a spectacle by reproaches. You've been made a spectacle because of tribulation. And then in verse 34, he says, you've accepted the plundering of your goods. So it'd be like you guys going home now, and somehow there's the seal of Pennsylvania stuck on your property and saying, by the way, this is no longer yours. Everything that you thought you had in your home that you were going home to is now gone. You have nothing now but the clothes on your back and the vehicle you rode in. Kind of similar what Robin and I experienced this weekend, because when we went up to the conference, I had the responsibility to pack our toiletries and our clothing and that kind of stuff, along with Bibles and books and computers. And when we went up to New Jersey, we got to the hotel room and we opened up the back of Robin's car and everybody pulls their stuff out. And Robin and I kind of look at each other and I go, oh, sorry about that, hon. I guess I forgot everything. So someone lent me a pen and I got a book and we were able to make do. And Robin very graciously is going to allow me to come home this afternoon, right? But they were in dire situations. And they are told then to hold fast without wavering. Wavering. The author here must have had some nautical background, because in chapter 2 he says, do not drift. And that very much was the mooring rope somehow is severed from the buoy or from the dock, and the tide is just slowly carrying the boat out. This one here of holding fast without wavering is also a nautical term. The hold fast without wavering is like looking straight forward. Straight forward. Steer the course of the ship straight towards God and don't waver. Steer the course of the ship to continue in the spiritual disciplines and do not stray from it. Steer the course of the ship into the role of the husband or the role of the wife or the role of the man or the role of the woman and do not drift from it. Just stay the course. And then it says hold fast. We are to hold fast because of God's faithfulness. I remember one time in Minnesota I took Robin deer hunting. What I was thinking, I don't really know. I took my southern Florida bride, who's only been married for a few years, who had never experienced a Minnesota winter before, who had never been out in the woods per se before, and had never been hunting before. So I put her up in a tree stand in the frigid, freezing cold Minnesota weather, and I put her up in this deer stand in the middle of the woods, and I say, honey, just sit quiet. Maybe a deer will go by. I'm going to another stand, and I will pick you up at dark. Now, apart from her physical condition, which probably was when I did get her, her body core temp was about 94 degrees. But apart from that, if she believed my promise that I was going to get her after the sunset, and she did not waver from that belief that I said that I would come and get her out of the tree and get her out of the woods when it was dark, what would be her mental condition or emotional condition when I went to get her? If she really believed it. It would be, yeah, glad you came. I don't think I'm going to do this again. Little cold for my taste. Didn't see a blessed thing, so thank you for that opportunity. Not going to do it again. But if she's sitting up in the tree and she's beginning to waver, if she's beginning to drift, and she starts letting her mind race, like, I wonder if he fell out of his tree stand and died. I've not seen anybody. I wonder if he remembers how to come get me. It's getting dark. I wonder if I know how I'm going to get out of here. I'm freezing cold. I wonder if I can even get out of the tree stand. If her faith is starting to waver, when I do come up and pick her up, what's going to be her emotional, mental state? A lot different. And it probably wouldn't be, gee, honey, thank you for that experience. I don't think I'm going to do it well. It didn't really suit my fancy. She would probably be ready to kill me. But, you know, for you and I in our lives, we're not up in a deer stand. We're in the trenches, to use another metaphor, because we do have financial struggles. We do have physical struggles. We have relational struggles. We have persecution within. We have persecution without. We got trouble in the home. We got trouble outside the home. And sometimes we just think, you know what? skip this. I'm going fishing. And we cannot waver from our faith. We just cannot do it. Because here's what happens. The present hardship of life can often eclipse one's present relationship with God, as well as eclipse the promises of God. We get so wrapped up in our suffering, and I'm not trying to marginalize it. I'm not trying to marginalize the suffering, but what we do is we let it become so big that it blocks out God, it blocks out His promises, and it also blocks out our responsibilities. Because even in the midst of the greatest, deepest tragedy or heartache or suffering, there are still just two great commandments, right? It's to love God and love others. But many times in the hardships and the suffering of life, we just kind of shrink it all down and it's just all about us. And we're not loving God and we're not loving one another. So we need to consider how to stir up one another in love and in good works. This word consider how we are to stir up one another, is the same word used in chapter 3 where we are to consider Jesus. Consider Jesus is one of those present active participles. You're just always to continue to do it. There's not supposed to be any variation. You're supposed to have this obsessive, compulsive thought on looking at the moral life of Jesus and how we can emulate that life. The same word here is used in chapter 10. We are to be considering these 50, 60 people compulsively how we can stir up Robin to love and good works, how we can stir up Jackie to love and to good works, how can we stir up Jennifer and Bill to love and good works. And again, as we saw there in the bottom of chapter 10, they're going through difficulty. And you and I know what happens when we get sometimes into difficulty. We shut down. And they need to be stirred up. And that word stir up has the idea of stimulation. Okay, if there are some people with some of these, whether it's a Trump rally or whether it's even a Clinton's rally, they would bring people to come in to instigate kind of like a riot. They would be instigators trying to stir up other people and try to make a disruption. This is the word that's being used for stir up. We're to carefully think through the brothers and sisters here in this church, how we can instigate them, motivate them, stimulate them to love and to good works. Love, that's just the sacrificial doing for others at personal cost. Just like the Good Samaritan there in Luke chapter 10, there's no desire for anything in return. There's no expectation for anything in return. We do it sometimes at personal expense. And then the good works. The good works, that word works, has the idea of energy. In fact, we get our English word energy out of it. This is what we're looking for. This is some texts I've gotten in the past. And we'd get a text from somebody and they'd say something like this: I know that I can count on God in my church family. God is so great and so is our church family. Because to some degree, our church is stirring one another up to love and good works. And we will unpackage that in a greater way down there in our growth groups. But the author of Hebrews knew that they were getting weary. And again, as you saw as we went through from chapter 2 to chapter 12, don't quit. Don't quit. Don't let go. Don't get mad at God. Just hold it fast. Just hold it fast. And they were getting weary, so he challenged them again and again. He knew that their hardships would become in their minds so large that it would eclipse God and His promises and others, and they would just become self-absorbed and just kind of trouble their trouble. So then he tells us to not neglect the meeting together as the habit of some. The context is so that we can encourage one another. You know why we should come to church? One of the reasons that we should come to church is because, first of all, God commanded it. Don't forsake the assembling of yourselves as the manner of such is. But in the prior verse, and then also down in the next verse, it is this verse as well, we should come to church to be thinking, how can I stir up Jackie for love and good works? And then also, as you see it there, we are to, let's go one more, to encourage one another. How can I encourage, as I mentioned earlier, Wally and Shirley? Just a really difficult time in her life. Shirley is, I've talked to her, and many of you have, she's got the right attitude of death. She knows she's going to die. There's nothing they can do really other than just retard it, slow it down. They can't knock it in remission. They can't cure her. They can just kind of give her just a few more days of life, however that is. And now her husband is not doing very well in rehab. So just a very difficult time. But it's not just her that needs encouragement. I would like to think that there's probably one or two of us here who would like to be encouraged. And that's, again, one of the reasons for the growth group. Because you and I both know that as soon as we leave here, we're going to get sucked up in the vortex of life, and before you know it, it's going to be Sunday again. And we had every intention of calling Robin or Jackie or Bill or Jennifer back there, and we really did, but the week evaporated. We had every intention of talking to them. We had every intention, but the week just disappears. So that's one of the reasons for the growth group, so that we can sit down here in this next hour coming and talk. And we can hear, again, some things they say or what they don't say. And then either during the growth group or after the growth group, we could encourage one another. Because, again, with just the culture and the way many times the families are and the workplaces, you're not going to get a whole lot of encouragement except but here. So we need you to come. Because it's commanded, we need you to come so to stir us up to love and good works. And we need you to encourage us, but you know what? You need us to encourage you. So, where do we end up with this? Here's kind of the application. When it says that we are to encourage one another, and all the more as we see the day approaching, the question is, who's us? Is this just my responsibility? Is it just the pastors, the deacons, the wives' responsibility? You know, where it says that we are to encourage one another and we are to stir up one another, the identity of that plural pronoun is every one of us in this room. We need to do this. And one of the best ways we can do it here is with the growth groups. So, tenacity. Tenacity. How tenacious are you in your faith? We must pay closer attention to what we heard. Do not drift away from the faith. Do not neglect such a great salvation. Do not stop considering Jesus. Take care, my brothers, lest there be in you an evil or unbelieving heart. Don't be dull of hearing. Don't be immature. Don't throw away your confidence. Don't grow weary or faint-hearted. So even though there may be the chronic pain, there may be the migraines, there may be the financial setback, there may be physical disability, and there may be hostility in the home, don't allow that to loosen your faith in God. When life is not giving what we want, when it's not giving or going as we had planned, it's easy to loosen our faith. It's easier to become self-absorbed, not stirring up others. And we're so busy with the struggles and the hardships of life, we don't have time to come to church. And then being in despair, it's almost impossible to encourage anyone else. Drifting is very easy to do But it doesn't need to be that way. Hold on to your faith. Let us work at stirring up one another. Let us be faithful to the meeting together. And let us be a Barnabas. Let us be an encouragement to one another.